Dr. Robert Vinoy, Exodus to Exile, Lecture 4A. Let's get back to where we left off last time, which was Roman numeral 2, quote, Israel in the wilderness, end quote, section D, quote, at Sinai, Exodus 19 through Numbers chapter 10, verse 10, end quote. And under D, we were at 1E. 1 is, quote, the establishment of the Sinai covenant, end quote. And E is, quote, the book of the covenant, Exodus chapter 20, verses 22 through chapter 23, verse 33, end quote. Remember we talked about the book of the covenant being the application of the foundational role of the Ten Commandments to more specific types of legal cases. We looked at some examples of that. Toward the end of that discussion, I mentioned that there were other ancient Near Eastern law codes in existence that have been excavated, translated, and published so that you can read these law codes. I listed 5 of them there on the slide 17, all of which, you notice, predate the time of Moses. We talked about the date of the Exodus, which is really a way to get at the date of Moses, depending on whether you are an early date view or a late date view. Moses will be 1400 through 1200 BC. And if you look at the dates of these law codes, they run down from 2000 to 1500 BC. So there are 5 law codes that are demonstrably earlier in time than what you might call the covenant code in Exodus chapter 20 through 23. Then what we did last time, we looked at one example of a comparison of a law from the law code to one of the laws of Eshnunna in this matter of ox goring, particularly verse 35 of Exodus 21, compared with law 53 of the code of Eshnunna. It is also identical. The wording is a little bit different, but the way in which the problem of ox goring is treated is certainly similar. I mentioned that toward the end of our last session. It raises the question of what is the relationship between the formulation of the law in the covenant code of Exodus chapter 20 to 23 with the formulation of laws in the ancient Near Eastern law codes. Towards the end of the hour, I suggested that I don't think there's any reason to conclude that it's not possible that the Lord took up into the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant Moses' awareness, knowledge, and familiarity with the legal traditions of the time. If you go back, as I mentioned, to Exodus chapter 18, verse 16, where Moses meets his father-in-law, Jethro, in the wilderness, and Jethro gives him the advice to appoint judges over thousands, hundreds, tens, and so forth, only the hard cases were to come to Moses. We read in verse 16 of Exodus 18, Moses says, quote, whenever you have a dispute, it is to be brought to me. I decide between the parties and inform them of God's decrees and laws, end quote. There's Moses informing Israel of God's decrees and laws before Sinai, and whatever way in which he did that, it is probably a similar thing to what is going on in the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant. So when you read in Exodus chapter 21, verse 1, quote, these are the laws you are to set before them, end quote, it seems to me that what that is telling us is that these laws have divine sanction, and the Lord is giving them to Israel through Moses and, in that process, taking up into their formulation Moses' knowledge of the legal tradition of his time. Now, having said that, that does not mean, as some attempt to argue, the biblical material simply borrowed from some of these other ancient law codes. I think, if you look closely, there are a lot of differences between the Book of the Covenant and the ancient Near Eastern law codes. I want to go through some of those differences. If you look at your citations on page 24, there are some paragraphs there from a volume called Themes in Old Testament Theology, written by William Dryness. In Dryness's discussion of the Book of the Covenant, he points out that there are many ways in which the literal material of the Book of the Covenant is far superior to what you find in these other ancient law codes. It is not only far superior, it is, in many ways, distinctly different, even though there are points of similarity, such as the ox-goring rule. Notice what he says. This is page 24 of the citations. Quote, "The superficial resemblance of Old Testament law to other law codes is undeniable, and it is instructive to ask what might be the relationship between them. We have already seen that in Israel it was God rather than the king who served as lawgiver. This put the idea of law in a unique perspective. In one sense, all of the Old Testament law was religious. Israel had a keen sense of this difference. Moses asks in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 8, quote, "What great nation is there that has statutes and ordinances so righteous as all this law?" End quote. They knew that God, quote, "has not dealt thus with any other nation," end quote. Psalm 147, verse 20. But at the same time, the similarities with neighboring law codes are also striking. These reflect not a wholesale borrowing, but, end quote. These are the words of Roland DeVoe, who was a French Old Testament scholar. Quote, "The influence of a single widespread customary law," end quote. In other words, there was a very widespread kind of customary tradition of that period of time. Quote, "Let us examine the relationship in more detail. In the first place, because the law is to safeguard the covenant relationship. Idolatry is severely condemned." Exodus chapter 20, verse 23, end quote. Notice in Exodus 20, verse 23, quote, "Do not make any gods to be alongside of me. Do not make for yourselves gods of silver or gods of gold," end quote. And in Exodus chapter 22, verse 20, quote, "Whoever sacrifices to any other god than Yahweh must be destroyed," end quote. So idolatry is condemned. Secondly, life is respected. Look at what Dryness says. Quote, "Moreover, life is seen to belong to God." Going back to Genesis chapter 9, verse 5, "Man is made in the image of God." That sets man in a unique way apart from other living creatures, so that when an ox kills a man, its flesh may not be eaten. Exodus chapter 21, verses 28 and 32. As a result, capital punishment is not nearly so common as it is in the case of the law code of Hammurabi. There, a wife that does not guard her property is cast into the river. Robbery is punishable by death, as is bearing false witness in a trial. Indeed, in general, the punishment stipulated in the Old Testament shows a restraint of gross brutality. End quote. So that's a second bullet under E, quote, "life is respected," end quote. Now, there were a fair number of offenses for which life was to be demanded. There were capital offenses in the Old Testament, but much less so than what you find in some other extra-biblical law codes. And thirdly, punishments show restraint. In general, there's much more restraint in the biblical law codes than in the extra-biblical law codes, and something that particularly stands out in connection with that is that there's no physical mutilation. If you look at Hammurabi's code, law 192, says, quote, "If the adopted son of a chamberlain or an adopted son of a devotee has said to his foster father or foster mother, 'You are not my father, you are not my mother,'" end quote, what shall they do? Quote, "They shall cut out his tongue," end quote. Mutilation, that kind of tradition, was still alive in some of the cultures in the Middle East. Law 193, quote, "If the adopted son of a chamberlain or and the adopted son of a devotee, identifies his own parentage and comes to hate his foster father or foster mother, and goes off to his parental home, end quote. What shall they do? Quote, they shall pluck out his eye, end quote. Law chapter 205. Quote, if a senior slave has struck the chief member of the aristocracy, they shall cut off his ear, end quote. Law 218. Quote, if a physician has performed major surgery on a senior with a bronze lancet and has caused the senior's death, and he has opened up the eye socket of the senior and destroyed the senior's eye, they shall cut off his hand, end quote. So if you're a surgeon and you botched your job, you're liable to lose your hand. But that sort of thing, physical mutilation, is pretty prominent in these ancient Near Eastern law codes. You don't find that when you read the biblical law codes. Fourthly, class distinctions are not prominent. On the middle of the page, on page 24, Dryness says, quote, the fact that all stood in the presence of God equally in the covenant relationship made it impossible for them to recognize a class distinction in their law. There is not one law for the free and another for the slaves. Indeed, slaves come in for particular protection in the law against cruel and demanding masters, end quote. So class distinctions are not prominent. They are prominent in these other law codes. In the biblical law codes, slaves are protected against abuses. Again, as Dryness goes on to say, quote, by contrast, most of the Near Eastern law codes stipulate different punishments for a person dependent upon his station in life. Hammurabi Code 203, if a citizen's status has struck the cheek of his equal, he shall pay one mina of silver, end quote. But notice the next law, quote, if the serf of a citizen has struck the cheek of one of citizen status, they shall cut off his ear, end quote. So you pay a fine if you're of higher social standing, you lose your ear if you are of a lower social standing. So slaves are protected against abuses in the biblical text. Immorality is punished severely, and in connection with that, marriages are protected or guarded. Dryness says, quote, because marriage is particularly important in God's sight and instituted by him, any infraction against chastity is severely punished. While promiscuity is punished in many law codes, outside the Old Testament, there are exceptions that are authorized by the law. But in the Old Testament, if a slave is treated improperly, she is to be treated just as if she were a wife. Exodus chapter 21, verses 7 through 11. If a man seduces a virgin, she shall become his wife. Exodus chapter 22, verse 16. Otherwise, adultery and fornication are punishable by death. The careful instructions in Leviticus about proper relations between a man and a woman are preceded by the warning that they are not to do as done in Egypt, where they had been, nor as is done in Canaan, where they are going, end quote. You see the practices of the Canaanites in the area of relationships between the sexes was radically different from what you find in Leviticus, quote, and the instructions close with the plea not to defile themselves by these practices, for I am the Lord your God, end quote. Leviticus chapter 18, verse 30. Ultimately, then, even human relationships were to reflect God's character and therefore were never to be understood only in terms of expediency. Unfaithfulness throughout the Old Testament was such an awful sin that God used it to illustrate the depth of Israel's unfaithfulness with him. And then finally, widows, fatherless, and strangers are protected. The weak of society are protected very clearly, and as Dryness says, quote, specifically, unique in the Old Testament law are the numerous provisions for the stranger or alien and for those who are handicapped in one way or another. There were instructions for the blind and deaf, for widows and the fatherless, and for the poor. Strangers were singled out for protection from oppression, for, it is explained, you should understand the heart of a stranger, since you were strangers in Egypt. God was especially concerned with the disadvantaged, of whom he says, "If they cry out to me, I will surely hear their cry." Exodus chapter 22, verse 23. One can almost hear Christ's words, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God." Luke chapter 6, verse 20. Poverty is not considered a virtue in the Old Testament, but it is recognized there, however unjust the fallen order is, and those who are special victims of its injustice provides God's people with a heaven-sent opportunity to express the mercy of God himself. End quote. If you look at Exodus chapter 22, verses 21 to 22, just for an example, you read there, quote, "Do not mistrust the alien or oppress him, for you were aliens in Egypt. Do not take advantage of the widow or the orphan. If you do, and they cry out to me, I will certainly hear their cry, my anger will be aroused, and I will kill you with the sword. Your wives will become widows, and your children fatherless." End quote. So it was to be taken very seriously the way widows, fatherless, and strangers were to be protected. You certainly can see the differences between the biblical law and the laws found in those other ancient Near Eastern law codes. We've looked at some of the specific differences. If you generalize, I think you can say there's a difference in religious spirit. There's a high degree of humanitarian concern, and the legal terminology as well as order and content differ. So, even though there are points in the covenant code where you see a reflection of the legal tradition of that particular period of time and culture, these differences are so prominent that I think it's quite clear that there's no direct borrowing from the external biblical law codes that's involved in the composition of the Book of the Covenant or the formulation of the laws of the Book of the Covenant. There are many laws that do not find a parallel in the extra-biblical law codes. So I think the conclusion to draw about this question of the relationship between the Book of the Covenant and the other ancient Near Eastern law codes is that there is a relationship, but it's indirect rather than direct. I think the point of Exodus chapter 21, verse 1, quote, "These are the laws you are to set before them," end quote, is that these are the laws that God desired his people to have at their particular point in time as they are being established as his covenant people. The Book of the Covenant is unique in its divine authority and in its plan, but at the same time it's rooted in the legal concepts of the day in which it was written. I think that's what we find generally with the way in which God speaks to his people. He comes to them in the language, thought forms, ideas, institutions, which they are familiar, and these laws are no different in that respect than any other institutions you may find in Israel. I think the point that's being made is that the penalty for a given offense should be commensurate with the severity of the offense. In other words, there is to be an equality in the severity of the penalty with the severity of the offense, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. In Hammurabi's code, when somebody does something insignificant, he loses his ear or his eye or his hand. There's a disparity between the penalty and the offense. Usually, even for an accidental death, there's no penalty at all. Accidental death is legislated in the biblical material. For accidental death, the death penalty would not be enforced. It's premeditated murder for which it is enforced. Generally, there would be some sort of a fine. Say somebody injured, somebody else's eye. You don't take it literally, they would take the other guy's eye from him. He'd pay a fine if he did something, but that's it. But there wouldn't be a physical mutilation. Let's go on to F. Quote, the covenant formally ratified. Exodus chapter 24, verses 1 through 11, end quote. After the presentation of this material, you read in verse 3, quote, when Moses went and told the people all the Lord's words and laws, they responded with one voice, everything the Lord has said, we will do. Moses then wrote down everything the Lord had said. He got up early the next morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, and set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Then he sent young Israelite men, and they offered burnt offerings, sacrificed young bulls, as fellowship offerings to the Lord. Moses took half of the blood and put it in bowls, and the other half he sprinkled on the altar. Then he took the Book of the Covenant, end quote. You ask why this material from chapter 20 to 23, called the, quote, Book of the Covenant, end quote, the title, or really the label, comes from this verse 7, quote, he took the Book of the Covenant, end quote. He took this legal material, quote, and read it to the people. They responded, we will do everything the Lord has said, we will obey. Moses then took the blood, sprinkled it on the people, and said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these works. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and drank, end quote. Now, this is covenant ratification, and you get key elements of a covenant ratification ceremony that appear in this description of Exodus chapter 24, verses 3 through 11. You have the covenant documentation mentioned in verse 4 and verse 7. Quote, Moses wrote down everything the Lord said. He read it to the people, end quote. You have the covenant stipulations referred to in verse 3. Quote, he told the people all the Lord's words and laws, end quote. And you have a covenant oath in verse 3 and verse 7, where the people say, quote, everything the Lord has said we will do, end quote. Notice that the oath is taken by the people. The oath is not taken by the Lord himself. The people are the ones who swear the oath. That brings up the difference that has been observed and often written about between what is called a promise covenant and a law covenant. I may have mentioned this earlier. In a promise covenant, such as the Abrahamic covenant or the Davidic covenant, God makes the promise and God makes the oath. If you go back to the ratification of the Abrahamic covenant, you have a description of that in Genesis chapter 15. In that chapter, you have the smoking, fiery furnace that moves between the slain halves of the animals in which the Lord is taking. What Meredith Klein has called a self-maledictory oath. Quote, so be it unto me if I do not fulfill the promise that I have made with you. End quote. In a law covenant, it's the people who made the oath. And in this case, the Sinai covenant is a law covenant, and it's the Israelites who swear to do all that the Lord has required of them. The other thing I want to call to your attention to here is the sprinkling of the blood. There are religious ceremonies, sacrifices, and sprinkling of blood. Look at your citations, page 27, on the sprinkling of blood. This is from J. A. Mottier. He says, quote, the blood moves first Godward in propitiation, and then, secondly, manward. And he took the Book of the Covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, all the Lord has spoken, we will do, and be obedient. and Moses took the blood and sprinkled it on the people. End quote. On what people did he sprinkle it? At what precise moment did that sprinkling of blood occur? At the moment when they committed themselves to a life of obedience. First comes the commitment to obedience according to the Lord God. All that the Lord has said we will do, and we will be obedient. Then the sprinkling of the blood manward. And what does that mean? It means that just as the blood of the covenant on the one hand establishes the relationship of peace with God by propitiation, so on the other hand the blood of the covenant maintains the relationship of peace with God for a people who are committed to walk in obedience. God knows that the people are professing beyond their strength. They have well said in what they have said, "Oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would keep all my commandments always." Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 28 and following. But they are professing beyond their ability. "Very well," says God, "I will make a provision for them. The same blood which made peace with God will keep peace with God. As they walk in the way of obedience, the blood is available for a people committed to obey. As they stumble and fall, so the covenant blood will be available for them." End quote. So you get a covenant ratification ceremony here, including these elements that are characteristics of such covenant ratification ceremonies. Let's go on to 2. This is sort of a parenthetical discussion that I'm inserting here because I think it's a fitting place to discuss it, and that is the subject of each of the ancient Near Eastern vassal treaties and the Sinai Covenant. That is a rather large issue that has a lot of implications, so I want to work through it with you. The whole idea of comparing the biblical covenant material with ancient Near Eastern international treaties, which is something today that is quite common in the literature, was a new idea in 1954 when George Mendenhall published some articles in the Biblical Archaeologist entitled, quote, "Law and Covenant in Israel and the Ancient Near East," end quote. That article is in your bibliography, if you look under this heading in your bibliography. The basic idea of Mendenhall's argument was that there were striking parallels to be observed between the literary genre of the biblical covenant and the literary genre of certain Near Eastern treaties, particularly those of the Hittite Empire. That was a new idea. That article is one of these unusual kinds of articles that's seminal in the sense that it produced a whole field of study. There are books and books and articles in the second half of the 20th century that came out of Mendenhall's calling attention to literary structural similarities between certain Hittite treaties and biblical covenant material. Those Hittite treaties have been around for years. They were uncovered in the early 1900s, and many of them were published in the 1920s and 30s. People had looked at them, were aware of their content, but nobody noticed the structural parallel between the Hittite treaties and the literary structure of the biblical covenant material. So here is a new field of study. Let's go on to A, quote, the Hittite treaties, end quote. The Hittite treaties come from what's called the New Hittite Empire, and were documents formulated during the reigns of five kings. There are some interesting names there listed on slide 22. The treaties can be divided into two groups of or types. Some are called vassal treaties, and the others parity treaties. A vassal treaty, which is the most common form, is a treaty between a superior and an inferior party. Sometimes a vassal treaty is called a suzerain treaty. The suzerain was the great king of the Hittite Empire. He was the senior partner through the treaty arrangements, while the vassal was the inferior partner. in a suzerain or vassal treaty, you have this disparity between the two partners of the treaty. It's only the inferior party who is bound by the oath to the stipulations of the treaty agreement. So the vassal takes the oath. As I said, the vassal or suzerain treaty is the most common form of treaty found from this period of time. But there are a couple examples of what's called a parity treaty. The best example is one between Ramses II and Hattusilas III. Now, Ramses II is that Ramses of the 19th dynasty of Egypt that we talked about, matching with the late date of the Exodus. Ramses took an army and fought with the Hittites way up in Syria on the Orontes River. There was a standoff. Neither one could really achieve a decisive victory. And what they did in conclusion of that battle is sign a parity treaty as equals. In a parity treaty, both partners take the oath, and they agreed not to re-engage in battle again. Egypt had its own area there to the south, and the Hittites had their area to the north. They came to a non-aggression pact. That's really what it is. Now, it's with the suzerain vassal treaties that you find a parallel with the biblical covenant treaty. The purpose of a suzerain or vassal treaty, according to Mendenhall in that article in 1954, was, quote, to establish a firm relationship of mutual support between the two parties, in which the interests of the Hittite sovereign were the primary and ultimate concern, end quote. In other words, there's a sense in which this treaty is an oath. The Hittite sovereign is the sovereign, and it's really his interests that are being guarded and protected by the stipulations of this treaty. The treaty is what's called, quote, unilateral, end quote. That is, it's only the inferior partner that is bound by the oath. Because of that, it meant that the vassal had to have a fairly large degree of trust in the Hittite suzerain, that the Hittite suzerain would do what he promised to do, and that the vassal would have the obligation to live up to the stipulations that the suzerain had placed upon him. If you read these treaties, you find that this idea of trust between the vassals and the Hittites' great kings was something that was common, and it was not unfounded, because the Hittite great kings had done benevolent things for the vassal. In other words, the Hittite king had treated the vassal in positive ways and done good things for him. So it wasn't a blind trust, but a trust based on past experience of the protective and helpful hand of the Hittite ruler. Let's go to the treaty form, as seen on slide 23. There are about 16 or 18 Hittite treaties that have been found, and if you look at the literary pattern that characterizes them, you will find that they follow a standard fixed pattern. There are six basic elements in the literary pattern of the suzerain vassal treaties. I'm going to say something about each of these elements in a minute. There's a preamble, a historical prologue, and then a basic stipulation, followed by detailed stipulations, followed by witnesses, and then blessings and curses. Now, with the preamble, you have the names and titles of the Hittite ruler. In other words, the preamble identifies the author of the treaty, the name and the titles of the Hittite ruler. That's followed by a historical prologue. And I think we can say that the historical prologue is probably the most significant element in the structure of the treaty form. The reason it is so important is that it sets the tone and the spirit for the treaty relationship. What the historical prologue does is gives a resume of the previous relationship between the great king and the vassal. What is emphasized are the benevolent works of the great king toward the vassal in the past. In other words, the Hittite king will say, quote, I've done this and this and this for you, end quote. It becomes clear that this is not just some sort of stereotype formula that's just attached to all treaties that all the great kings of the Hittite Empire make, because all the historical prologues are different. They're specific, and they're regarded by people who have studied them as resumes that contain valid historical information. Some of them are very lengthy and detailed. Some of them are very short. But they describe events in the past involving the two treaty partners. They perform the function of making the case for both gratitude and trust and sense of obligation for the vassal toward the great king. In other words, the great king says, quote, I've done this and this for you, end quote. And then you move down into the stipulations, and then he says, quote, this is what I expect of you, end quote. The vassal has a reason to trust the great king because he has helped him in the past, but he also has an obligation toward the great king because of what the great king has done in the past. So that historical prologue has a very important function in setting up the spirit of the relationship between these two parties. This flows quite naturally into the third element of the treaty form. The third element is what is called the basic stipulation, sometimes called the statement of substance. That's a rather brief, general clause that summarizes the obligation of loyalty on the part of the minor treaty partner towards the great king, the fundamental obligation of loyalty. In one of the treaties after the historical prologue, this is a treaty from Murcilus with a vassal, but that basic stipulation reads, quote, now keep the oaths of the king and protect the power of the king, end quote. There's your obligation. There's your fundamental obligations. Quote, keep these oaths, protect the power of the great king, end quote. From another of the treaties, also by Marcellus, with another individual from Ugarit, he says, quote, you, Nicnepha, end quote, which is the name of the vassal king, quote, from now on into days of the future, you shall be faithful to the king of Hatti, end quote, which is the king of the Hittites. Quote, in days to come, keep this pact of friendship with the king of Hatti, the sons of the king, and with Hatti, end quote. So this is a statement of the fundamental obligation of loyalty on the part of the vassal toward the great king, which flows out of the historical prologue, where the beneficent and benevolent acts of the great king toward the vassal were enumerated. Then that's followed by the detailed stipulations in the fourth section of the treaty. And there you get, rather than the general statement of obligation of loyalty, specific things that are expected of the vassal. Prohibit of other foreign relationships. The vassal must not permit any evil words against the great king. The vassal is to appear before the Hittite king once a year, bringing annual tribute. Controversies between the vassals are to be submitted to the great king for judgment. And on and on and on, detailed kinds of stipulations and the kinds of things that the great king expected from the vassal. That is followed by a listing of the gods as witnesses. The gods who are enumerated are the gods of the Hittites, that is, of the great king, as well as the gods of the vassal, and usually these lists are quite lengthy. And it's the deities that will ensure that this is a binding document, which flows naturally into number 6, the blessings and the curses. If you obey your obligations, you will enjoy the blessings of these deities. If you disobey the stipulations, both the basic and the detailed stipulations, you will then experience the curses of these various deities. So the gods are the enforcers, you might say, of the curses and the blessings. Usually the curses are given first, followed by the blessings. The curses include such things as sterility, poverty, plague, famine, misery, things of that sort. The blessings are continuity of the vassal's line. That was always an issue. Who was going to succeed on the throne? Health, prosperity, peace, things of that sort. So that's the structure of the Hittite treaties. Mendenhall, way back in 1954, when he wrote the original article that pointed the structure out, he also said that in some of the treaties, not in all of the treaties, where generally the structure is consistent, in some of the treaties, however, you have reference to a few other additional features. A formal oath pledged by the vassal, a ratification ceremony, a form of procedure against the rebellious vassal, and fourth, provision for the deposit of the treaty document in the vassal's sanctuary with a public reading, with a periodic public reading. In some of the treaties, you have references to some of those items as well. Now, that is B, quote, the form of the vassal treaties, end quote. Lowercase c on your outline is, quote, the Hittite treaties of the second millennium differ in form from the later treaties, end quote. When I speak here of later treaties, I'm thinking particularly of 7th century Assyrian treaties from the time of Esarhaddon and 8th century Aramaic treaties, which some call Sapphire. So, the Hittite treaties have a different form from the body of treaties that come from the 7th and 8th centuries BC. When you look at the treaties here of the Sapphire, that is the Aramaic treaties, and the Assyrian treaties of Esarhaddon, this chart on slide 28 is adapted from K.A. Kitchen's article in Biblical Archaeology. Here's the structure. Title, witnesses, stipulations, and curses. Sapphire treaties, title, witnesses, curses, and stipulations. You compare that with the Hittite treaty and the biblical covenant material, where you have title, prologue, stipulations, deposit, witnesses, blessings, and curses. You see there's a different structure. And the striking thing about both the Assyrian and the Aramaic treaties of the 7th and 8th centuries is that there is no historical prologue. In the Hittite treaties, you have a historical prologue, but in the Assyrian and Sapphire treaties, there is none. You have the title, the author of the treaty, stipulations, the witnesses, and curses. What that means is you have a very harsh tone, particularly in the Assyrian treaties. The wording is the ruthless imposition of Assyrian power over some vassal state. There's no hint of any benevolent or merciful actions on the part of the Assyrian ruler toward the vassal in the previous relationship. There's no basis for trust. There's nothing that would merit loyalty, thankfulness, gratitude toward the great king. What you find here is a declaration of obligations imposed on the vassal with horrible curses if the vassal does not obey those obligations. Then you notice there are no blessings, only curses. So you see, if you look at the Hittite structure, where you have that historical prologue that describes the benevolent actions of the great king towards the vassal, and that includes blessings as well as curses, you have an entirely different tone or spirit in the relationship between the treaty partners. Now, having said that, let me go back. Notice on your outline that C was, quote, the Hittite treaties differ in form from these later treaties, end quote. But D is, quote, the treaties and the biblical covenant, end quote. If you looked at the Hittite structure and then look at the biblical covenant materials, there are various evangelical scholars who have worked with this, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, so you can debate exactly how to weigh this out. But I've used here K.A. Kitchen and J.A. Thompson. you can look in your bibliographies for their writings. When you come to the biblical material, the covenant is, of course, established at Sinai. That's where we are in the book of Exodus. That covenant was renewed 40 years later after the wilderness wanderings on the plains of Moab. The book of Deuteronomy is really a covenant renewal document. It seems that covenants, being particularly concerned with succession and leadership, were typically renewed at the point of a change in leadership. Moses is at the point of his death when he comes to the plains of Moab. Therefore, part of the reason for the renewal of the covenant at that point in time was to provide for the transition of leadership from Moses to Joshua. You get there what some have called, quote, dynastic succession, end quote. When a vassal's leader died and you have a succession, there would be a renewal of the treaty with the great king. So here you have Moses and Joshua, and there's a lot of attention given to that succession if you read carefully through Deuteronomy. It's appropriate to have a covenant renewal ceremony. When you come to the end of the book of Joshua, Joshua chapter 24, Joshua's at the point of death, and he gathers all Israel to Shechem. And there Israel again renews their allegiance to the Lord at the point of transition of leadership from Joshua into the period of the judges. I think the purpose of these renewals was to provide for covenant continuity through a period of transition in leadership. So you have the covenant established in Exodus, renewed in the book of Deuteronomy, and renewed in Joshua chapter 24 at the point of the death of Joshua. The next covenant renewal is 1 Samuel chapters 11 and 12, where there was, at the time of the transition from the judges to the monarchy, a major transition in the structure in the leadership of the theocracy. Kingship is established in the context of a covenant renewal ceremony held at Gilgal. So as you look at Exodus, you can look at Deuteronomy. You can look at Joshua 24. You can look at 1 Samuel chapter 12. And what you find is that those elements of the Hittite treaty form appear rather clearly in all those biblical materials. Now, what Kitchen and Thompson have done here on slide 25 is take those elements, preamble. Kitchen finds it in Exodus 21 for the Exodus passage. Thompson in Exodus chapter 19 verses 3 to chapter 20 verses 2a. In Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 1 verses 1 through 5. And in Joshua, Joshua chapter 24, verse 2, and so on with the historical prologue, the basic stipulation, the detailed stipulations, the witnesses, the curses, and the blessings. Notice with the witnesses, a difference here is you don't have deities as witnesses. In Exodus chapter 24, verse 4, quote, Moses wrote down everything the Lord said. He got up early the next morning, built an altar at the foot of the mountain, set up 12 stone pillars representing the 12 tribes of Israel, end quote. There were the witnesses, the 12 stone pillars. If you go to Joshua chapter 24, verse 27, for example, you read, quote, See, he said to all the people, This stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to you. It will be a witness against you, if you are untrue to your God. End quote. In Deuteronomy, Moses calls heaven and earth as witness to the treaty that Israel has made with the Lord. So you have witnesses, and you have curses and blessings. So to get back to Mendenhall's original article, the thing that Mendenhall called attention to was the structure of the Hittite treaties, and then he reflects on very similar structures in the biblical covenant material. Now, Meredith Klein, who is an evangelical who did a lot of work on the analogy between the Hittite treaty materials and the biblical covenant materials, wrote a book called The Treaty of the Great King, and that book was a discussion of this analogy between the Hittite treaties and the biblical covenant materials, but at the same time, a commentary on the book of Deuteronomy. When he gives the title of that book, The Treaty of the Great King, he is saying in essence that Deuteronomy is a covenant document. That is, the Treaty of the Great King, and the Great King is Yahweh. He outlines Deuteronomy, I think legitimately, in a way that reflects the treaty structure. You see, there is a preamble, the historical prologue, stipulations, the great commandment, specific commandments, more detailed ones, sanctions, covenant ratifications, including blessings and curses. There is also a dynastic disposition, covenant continuity. That's the transition in leadership between Moses and Joshua. Klein, I think, did a good job in showing how Deuteronomy reflects the treaty form. Now, what Klein does beyond that in his book, The Treaty of the Great King, is to point out some of the implications that flow from the similarity of the Hittite treaty form and the biblical covenant material. Look at your citations, page 28, paragraph A. He says, quote, "The position to be advocated here is that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document, which in its total structure exhibits the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. In light of the evidence now surveyed, it would seem indisputable that the Book of Deuteronomy, not in the form of some imaginary original core, but precisely in the integrity of its present form, the only one for which there is any objective evidence, exhibits the structure of the ancient suzerainty treaties in the unity and completeness of their classic pattern." End quote. Now, you'll notice he's talking about Deuteronomy in its present form. In other words, in the structure of the entirety of the book, rather than in the form of some imaginary original core. It's been typical of critical scholars over the past century to say that Deuteronomy is a late composition, and that its original core was chapters 12 through 26, and then chapters 1 through 11 were added later, and chapters 27 through 34 were added later still, and all of which was much later than the time of Moses. Now, you see what Klein is saying is Deuteronomy reflects a literary structure in its total composition, not in some original core with added material at its beginning and its end, but as an original composition. He says, quote, "that there should be a measure of oratorical and literary enrichment of the traditional legal form is natural, considering the caliber of the author and the grandeur of the occasion. And, of course, there is the conceptual adaptation inevitable in the adoption of common formal media for the expression of the unique revelation of God in the Scriptures." End quote. In other words, the Hittite treaty form is not just transposed in some kind of mechanical way into the material of Deuteronomy. There is certain freedom with which that form is used, and of course, there's an enormous difference between some human king imposing a treaty on a vassal and God entering into a covenant relationship with his people. So there's some differences, but the general structure is the same, and he concludes with this statement. Quote, "What is remarkable is the detailed extent to which God has utilized this legal instrument of human kingdoms for the definition and administration of his own redemptive reign over his people." End quote. In other words, here's another example of how God speaks in the legal forms of the time in which this revelation was given, with which the covenant was established. He uses something that was familiar to the people of that time in order to structure the relationship between him and his people. Now, Klein works out further some of the implications of this. The first is the implication for the date of Deuteronomy. Look at paragraph B at the bottom of page 28 in your citations. Quote, "The implications of the new evidence for the questions of the antiquity and authenticity of Deuteronomy must not be suppressed. The kind of document with which Deuteronomy has been identified did not originate in some recurring ritual situation. These treaties were, of course, prepared for particular historical occasions. It is necessary, therefore, to seek for an appropriate historical episode in the national life of Israel in order to account satisfactorily for the origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty. Without now rehearsing all of the data that make it perfectly apparent that the addressees were the recently founded theocratic nation, we would press only one question. Where, either in monarchic or pre-monarchic times, except in the very occasion to which Deuteronomy traces itself, can an historical situation be found in which the 12 tribes would have been summoned to a covenant engagement whose particular purpose was, as to the purpose of the Deuteronomic Treaty, demonstrably was, to guarantee the continuance of a non-Davidic dynasty over Israel, end quote. In other words, this is the issue of dynastic succession from Moses to Joshua, and that's an important element in the book of Deuteronomy. Where else would this fit, other than at the end of Moses' life? So, he says that as an implication for the date. That next paragraph at the top of page 29, quote, another index of the time of Deuteronomy's composition is provided by the evolution of the documentary form of suzerainty treaties. Admittedly, the available evidence is still quite limited, and the differences among the extant treaties are not to be exaggerated. It is indeed one species that we meet throughout Old Testament times. Nevertheless, there is a discernible evolution. For example, where the beginning is preserved in the first millennium BC treaties at Sephir and Nimrud. It is not the opening Umma of the second millennium BC Hittite treaties or its equivalent. So the Sephir treaties, only a trace remains of the blessing sanctions, which are prominent in the earlier treaties, and the sanctions of Esarhaddon's treaties consist exclusively of curses. The most remarkable difference is that of the historical prologue. The distinctive second section of the second millennium treaties is no longer found in the later texts, end quote. We talked about that a minute ago. So in his next paragraph, he says, quote, accordingly, while it is necessary to recognize a substantial continuity in the pattern between the earlier and the later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium BC as the, quote, classic, end quote, form, and without any doubt, the book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic stage in this documentary evolution. Here, then, is significant confirmation of the prima facie case for the Mosaic origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty of the Great King, end quote. See what he's arguing there is if you look at the structure of the treaties from the third millennium down to the first millennium, over 2,000 years, the structure of the Hittite treaties, which he calls the classic form of the treaty, is what parallels the biblical treaty material. If you go back to the third millennium BC, the structure is quite different. If you go earlier, it's different. If you go later, it's different. I think there are 16 to 18 Hittite treaties. There are about 85 treaties recovered over the period of 2,000 years, and if you look at them, you'll see the structures differ through time. The biblical material corresponds to the Hittite form. The Hittite form dates to the Mosaic era, the 1400s to the 1200s. You go later? The traditional argument of critical scholars is that Deuteronomy was written in the 6th or 7th century, late in Israel's history. Usually, the origin of Deuteronomy has been said to be the time of Josiah in 621 BC, when the law book was found in the temple by Hilkiah the priest, who takes it to Josiah. The traditional critical view is that the law book was Deuteronomy. It was represented as being Mosaic, but it was written by religious leaders of Jerusalem for the purpose of centralizing worship in Jerusalem in the time of Josiah. So that Deuteronomy dated late is an almost unanimous consensus among critical scholars. Deuteronomy is to be dated at 621 BC. What Klein is saying is, if you look at the literary form of the book of Deuteronomy, that form is rooted back in the 1200s to 1400s, the time of Moses, the time of the Hittite great king, not at the time of the Esarhaddon treaties in the 7th century BC. So those are the implications for date. I said then that there are also implications for the manner of transmission. We'll have to look at that next time. Dr. Robert Vinoy, Exodus to Exile, Lecture 4A.